Good morning, my name is Pete, I'm a recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be here and thank the two groups that are putting this together to have us here. A little intimate setting for the next few hours. June 23rd, 1988 was my last drink, and I've been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous since. And it's because of the sacred rooms and sponsorship, the big book, which all brought me to a loving God. I'm still here, still kicking around and still seeking and trying to grow an understanding and effectiveness to pass this message on. So I'm really grateful for that. I'm just going to go, something came to me while we were doing meditation. I like to observe, and just some suggestions when we're doing meditation. It's sacred. Some people say it's more important than prayer. I'll leave that up to you. But when we do meditate, really to center, it's so important that we have proper posture. And so when we're meditating, and we do the best we can in chairs and in a setting like this, and if we're home, we have a mat and we sit in a certain posture, but even if we're sitting in a chair, because some folks can't sit in posture on the floor because of bad backs and such. But if we're sitting in a chair, the ideal situation is to kind of remove sunglasses and eyeglasses and have comfortable clothes on and remove baseball caps and things. And the last thing you want to do is be crossing your legs or have your arms folded. If we sit with feet flat, and if you're right-handed, you put your right hand down and your left hand on top of it, and vice versa if you're a lefty. So it looks like this. And pay real close attention to your shoulders, because most of us are walking around saying, I'm really spiritual and relaxed, and we look like this all day long. And watch the shoulders. And just breathe. And the simple method is breathing in one and breathing out two, and just focus on breath. And when you get to do that, you'll quickly see how much noise we have in the head. Because as soon as you settle down, it's still going. It's kind of like when you're driving in your car with a whole bunch of groceries on the front seat and hit the brakes, the car stops and the groceries keep going. That's what it's like when you begin to meditate. And you'll see how noisy we are, and we're walking around with that noise all day long and trying to navigate through that, and how we are so dominated by the mind, which all this does is create noise. So just be mindful of that moving forward when you're meditating. I thought you could do a rap song for me any minute. I'm meditating, you know. Just relax and easy. And with meditation, there's posture. Everything I've studied and my teachers, posture and breath are the two big pieces. Other than that, it's like prayer. It's your own walk. You know, what you're meditating about, what you're seeing, what you want to listen to. Some of us have meditation tapes and music and sage and all this other stuff. It's all good. I did that at the beginning to help me kind of center and some teaching tools. We evolved to a place where we don't need anything. You know, you go meditate in the back room for a half hour, 20 minutes or 10 minutes, whatever it might be. And the last thing I'll say is, when I first started meditating, I had someone teach me. And she put me on a timer for like 2 minutes. And I said, oh, come on, that's novice stuff. And 2 minutes took forever. And I was thinking of a million things I had to do besides this meditation. Let's get this over. Let me get it over with and get back to running my life. And 2 minutes, we put me on 3 minutes, and they put me on 4 minutes, and then 5 minutes, and somewhere around the 7-8 minute mark, literally on a timer, when the bell went off, I was done. I didn't need a timer anymore. And there was it's like if you go to the gym, well, I run, and Marion swims, and your body gets into the rhythm. You know, a couple of minutes, and then your body responds to that. Same thing with meditation. Your body, the spirit will respond to where it has to put you. And after 5 minutes or so, you're in. Now, what we can get into, and I watched this happen years ago, it's a contest of who meditates longer, meaning I'm more spiritual. I meditated for 4 hours this morning. I got up at 2 a.m., you know. I didn't make it to work, but I'm spiritual. So don't do that. That's bondage, and that's ego. We try to do about 10 minutes at least. But if I'm meditating and I'm in minute number 8 and Marion says, hurry up, there's an emergency, I'm not going to shout back. While meditating is going to have to wait. You know, you respond to life because that's what we're getting ready for. So 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, some of us do longer. Mind fluctuates. I pay no attention to the time anymore. It's when God needs me and he calls me in and he sends me out, he sends me out. So having said that, we hope to talk about the steps, experiential talk. With the time frame, it's hard to really chop up the book. I'm sure we'll refer to the book and some other literature we have here and talk about step one, which really the book dedicates 43 pages that we know to step one. And when we look at doctor's opinion, we have about 10 pages that talk about step one in that as well as the obsession and the psychic change or spiritual awakening. But if you think about it, 43 pages are all about step one. And the rest of the chapters are broken up into steps. Steps are broken up into the chapters, but they really needed to have us pay attention to the lack of power, choice, control. And we have our stories. When we talk about our stories, which Marion's going to take it in a second, when we look at the first 9 pages of Bill's story, it's Bill's testimony, it's Bill's story on his lack of power, choice, control, and the unmanageability in his life as a direct result of drinking and the futile attempts he made to stop until he bottomed out and was met with God in the town's hospital. So that's what we do when we tell our stories, what it was like living life on self-will, what happened to spiritual awakening, what it's like now living in the sunlight of the Spirit, because that's what you're going to identify with. If no one knew me and I came in and started pontificating about the big book, that sounds really nice, but who are you and how'd you get here and how do I identify with you? So we'll kick it around. We'll see where Spirit moves us. And Mary and I always pray before we do these things, and we always in our prayers bless everyone who walks through the room for an open mind and an open heart. And last thing, there's something that says, God, please let me lay aside everything I think I know about the big book, the 12 steps, AA, and you, God, for an open mind and a new experience. God, please let me see my truth. And we will find that the truth is true until we find out it no longer risen. So it's about peeling back the onions, the layers of the onion. You know, I came into AA, there were certain things I thought were true, and as I start to awaken, I find out they were lies. And that's all part of the process. So what I like to do, if it's cool, just give it to Marion so you guys know who she is and some of her walk. So here's Marion.
Thanks, Peter. I'm Marion. I'm a recovered alcoholic and addict. And it's great to be here and great to be clean and sober. And
Speak up.
Yeah. Okay. Sit up, speak up. It's really great. We just an honor to be here. This weekend, my sobriety date is November 11th, 1989, and I have to tell you, this weekend with Peter, you know, doing the CA talks this weekend, that's where my journey started, was in CA, and I've been sober 27 and a half years, by God's grace, but this has been, it's kind of been reflective for me, when I went into a treatment center the day after my 30th birthday in 1989, and I was a housewife with 3 little kids at home, and I was smoking cocaine in my closet with a box of wine, a bag of weed, matted hair, and you know the closet door closed with the blinds closed in the bedroom, with the cops peering through the window, knowing that they could see me in the closet. And I don't know if you guys have ever been there, but that's a really scary place to be. And where I was then and where I am today, I'm just blown away. It's blown away that that God could do, you know, save a wretch like me, like an old song likes to say, you know. And to be you know, I have a great sponsor. My sponsor sponsored. My sponsor sponsor sponsored. You know, I have a home group. I have tons of women I sponsor. I work in the recovery field, And I just can't believe I have the life I have today. And, you know, I came in just hating everything about me and so desperate, so self-loathing. I had three little kids that were 6, 7, and 8 years old when I made it to the rooms. And a year before that, I had a three-month-old son that was died a crib death in January of 1987. And that same year, the end of 1987, my mom died. And, you know, I was already, you know, it was like the way I was raised. I was, you know, my mom and dad were alcoholics, and we had the shameful house. My teacher would wash my face, and, you know, my teacher would comb my hair, and we had seven kids in our family, and alcoholism and addiction ran rapid in our family. And, you know, I just always had this sense and this knowing that I was wrong, you know, that, you know, the difference between shame and is just knowing that, you know, you're just not right. And that's the way I live my life. It's always feeling different and always feeling like I wasn't a part of the whole thing. And, you know, there was the little girls with the bows in the hair and their Barbie dolls, and I didn't have that. And I was always just, it was just off. And you know, I took care of my mom and I took care of my dad, and I broke up their fights, and my brothers and sisters would send me down to break up their fights. And so I had this, I always felt like I didn't need a God, because I could play God in my family. You know, I could play God. I could change circumstances. I still kind of can get caught up in that thing of like our big book talks about, the we're like the actors trying to run the whole show, and that was my deal. I could sing and dance and make mom and dad happy and all that stuff. And you know, I was 17 years old, and I was at this party, and I see this guy, and he's like, it's in the 70s, and he's pissed off, and he's yelling at this guy, and he's in a fight, and he had no shirt on and these blue stretchy cords, and I looked across the room, and it's like love at first sight. And and what I know today is I found my dad, and I was like, okay, here's the guy I'm going to fix. And I was in that marriage for 25 years, and he was an addict, and he never got these rooms. And what happened for me is, like, I'm all, you know, the church believer and all that stuff. That's part of my spiritual walk. But and there was a lot of recovery that had to happen. I just feel like God's taken me down this journey this weekend of really looking back and reflecting on where my life was. And, you know, I got clean and sober. And the first 10 years of my marriage, I was drunk and I was high. And the last 15 years of my marriage, I was sober and clean, and I was running after God and running after this program with everything I had. And my ex was using and abusing, and I mean using and abusing drugs and alcohol, but also using and abusing me and my children. And so I recover from a hopeless state of mind and body with drugs and alcohol, but I also recover from a hopeless state of mind and body as being a victim of domestic violence, and overcoming losing a child and losing my mom. And And what I've found in my life is being, you know, becoming a woman of, I use this all the time, turning my scars into stars, becoming a woman of grace and dignity. And that doesn't mean I have to wear a dress and heels and look pretty. I mean, I'm just grounded to the earth as I can be today. But what it is a condition of the heart, you know, a condition of who God's made me to be. Is I don't need the validation of a man. I need a validation from God. I don't need, you know, that communication and that link that I have to God today is something that's, I have to have a spiritual experience every single day that's sufficient enough to overcome my alcoholism and addiction. And I believe that, like, I know I'm kind of all over, I don't know that I'm all over the place. I am where I am. But we were having a talk last night, Tarek and Peter and I were, and whether it's like we're living in the bedevilments and having problems in emotional relationships and finances and romances and circumstances, whether I'm having problems there, or whether I'm a heroin addict, a cocaine addict, whether I'm an alcoholic, whether I smoke a lot of weed, no matter what that is, I need to have a spiritual experience sufficient enough to overcome any of those circumstances. So I feel like, for me, this is my opinion, is that it's all about God, no matter what. No matter what. I can only find forgiveness for others. I can only find mercy for others. I can only find peace and love and all that stuff through my relationship with God. And what am I doing about that? And when I wound up in the rooms of CA at the beginning, you know, I checked into treatment. I was just going to overcome this little cocaine problem I had, you know. And I got there and I was in such denial about my alcoholism that when they did my intake, it's like I didn't know that, you know, people lie on intakes. And I was just telling them the truth. Of course I've had blackouts. Of course I have done things that, you know, all those questions. I'm answering the question, and I'm sitting there in treatment, and they're like, they diagnosed me a late second stage chronic alcoholic. And I said, wait a minute. I just came here because I'm smoking too much crack in the closet, you know? And what do you mean I have to give up weed? I come from Bellingham, Washington, the hippie capital of the United States, and it was in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most hippies per capita. And I was like, and the deal was, is like, but what happened for me is I was a person in the book that I was trying all these different methods in order to overcome. Okay, in order, you know, and it was always back to the book where, oh, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing, you know? Oh, telling my husband, swearing off with or without a solemn oath one more time. It's like, here she goes again, you know? And the morning of November 11th, 1989, my neighbor had gone to treatment like 6 months before that. And I'd gone to one AA meeting. I really hadn't heard anything. There was just a bunch of old, crusty people in a smoky, billowed room. And I was like, great, this is where I've landed, you know? But here it was, fast forward a year later, and I go downstairs, and, you know, I had this 80s perm that was all matted like Bob Marley. And, you know, I had a leopard print shirt I wore the night before for my 30th birthday. And I came downstairs into my bright pink bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I saw something I'd never seen before in my entire life. Never saw it. You know, I tried so, my life was so dark, and it was so dim, and it was so black, and it was so ugly. And I looked in the mirror that morning, and we can talk about the different form, and I'm like all about God in various different forms, but that morning I got the gift of desperation. And I know that I saw something I hadn't seen before. A book talks about we stood at the turning point. You know, I couldn't see my life with a drink or a drug, and I couldn't see it without it. And it just, something pierced through my eyes when I looked at that mirror. And it was so crazy because I had this little brother who was a heroin addict who lived underneath a bridge. And, you know, God was showing up in my life way before that. And it's so weird. We get in the program and we're like, oh, where's this God in my life? But I don't know if you're like me, but there was many times I would go to bed where my heart was pounding out of my chest. And I'd be like, God, help me through the night. Help me through the night. And then I'd come to in the morning and I made it through again. But did that, you know, it was like, no, by 5 o'clock that day or noon that day, I'm hitting it again, you know? And that morning of November 11th, you know, I walked out and I told my husband I'm going to treatment because Daryl, my neighbor, went. And this was the next bright idea I had, you know, swearing off with or without a solemn oath. I mean, I would just quit the cocaine and I'll just stick to the weed. I'll just not drink hard liquor and I'll just drink booze. And, you know, all these methods and forms that I tried. And I know when I hit my bottom that day, it's like I'd exhausted my options. And I don't know if you're like me, but my options were done that day. And there's never been a moment and there's never been a time where I look back, except for my third day in treatment. Well, there was two times. My third day in treatment, they've got me, you know, I'm laying there in the bed. I had this God of my understanding because I started sending my kids to this little Sunday school and kind of got a little God consciousness through that. And I'm laying in this detox bed, and where Peter was talking, you know, about the first 43 pages of the big book where it talks about this disease centers in our mind. And somehow I got the little idea on that third day laying in detox that I had overreacted. Why am I in treatment? I'm feeling a little better now, and it's time to go home and be a good mom and show up for the PTA meetings and do all those things that I need to do. And they sent in a couple people. And I'll never forget those. And the longer you girls and you gentlemen stay around this program, you will have heroes, ultimate, beautiful, amazing heroes, people that have left these footprints, these, I don't know, tattoos on our heart, if you want to say it that way, whatever. And there was this gentleman in the treatment center. His name was Steve Nobles. He was like 6'8", and he was just this big. He ran around barefoot all the time, and all he did was he would talk about how God put him on this planet to love people. Him and his wife were just these beautiful NAACA gurus, and they had nothing but love. And he was just the kindest, gentlest soul. And he came in and he sat at the end of the bed with this nurse, Becky Treat. I'll never forget her as long as I live. And they sat down at the end of the bed. And for the first time in my life, they spoke the language of the heart. And there was the identification that you guys had. Because, see, I had this God in my life. And when I was high, I would sit home with my box of wine, and I'd have my bag of Coke. And it's so weird to talk about all of this because I don't usually do that in the rooms of AA, but I guess I'm free to do that here, you know. And I would sit around, and I had not the big book, but I'd have the Bible, and I had this highlighter, and I'd be stoned out of my mind, and my husband was off in his disease. And I would just highlight these pages, and I was like seeking this God and putting all these substances in my body. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't get this thing. And that morning and that day, 3 days in that detox, when they sat at the end of the bed, what happened was the missing piece for me. And that was another addict, another alcoholic, sitting at the end of the bed and talking about what this disease had done to them. And for the first time in my life, I didn't feel like I was alone. And I think that's what happens in the mercy and the grace of that moment, is when I know you get me and I get you. And you, and it's like this lifeline is thrown out. And it's like they gave me hope that day. That holy, I want to swear right now, but holy crap. You know, you get me and I get you, and you have a solution to what's going on in my life. You felt you felt the way that I felt. You thought the way that I thought. You drank the way that I drank. You used the way that I used. And I'm not just this wretched, horrible, miserable piece of crap that I always thought I was. You're that miserable because just like me. And somehow we know that, you know, when people would tell their stories, and they were just, sometimes I needed to hear people that were worse off than me. It's like, whew, I'm not that bad. Or that they could hear my story, and that my story would give them hope. So that day, you know, revolutionized and changed my life. You know, it's like God just threw me that lifeline. And, you know, I wouldn't forget those faces of they bring in CA meetings and they bring in NA meetings and they bring in AA meetings into the treatment center, and we worked through the first 3 steps while we were there, and so then that offered me this opportunity. Okay, we get to go to an outside meeting, and so I go to this outside. Oh, first of all, so God starts showing up in my life. You know, they used to say, like, and if you're new here, you know, looking for those. I think that God just uncovers us enough that we're actually awakened enough to be able to see things differently. Like we go for these walks in the park. We go in the morning. We'd walk to Cornwall Park. It was across, and it's November, and the leaves are orange, and the trees are green and orange, and the wind is blowing. And I'd walk over to the park, and it felt alive. And it's like, it felt like almost like a new pair of glasses even at that point, where I could see the colors and I could breathe the air and I could get on these swings with these other women in the treatment center and just like swing really high. And I felt like I was a kid, that I was alive and I was given this hope. And so God just like spoke to me through nature and spoke to me through working the steps. And, you know, I'd go to this meeting, these meetings, and you know, they bring them into the treatment center, and somebody would say something, be like, oh my God, that's me. Oh my God, that's me. I get it, you know? And so what happens is they say, oh, okay, well, we're going to give you a temporary sponsor, and you're going to go to an outside meeting on a Friday night. And, you know, my head starts running wild, and I'm like, oh my God, you know, it's Friday night. And I'm going to an AA meeting at Dry Dock. You know, wow, how cool. This is what my life has become. You know, what a loser I am now, you know. And they send me this woman to be my temporary sponsor. Now, my ex-husband was working for this roofing company, and there was this little gal named Dawn. And apparently she gotten sober, and I kind of knew that in the back of my mind. And the one person I know on the whole planet, besides my little sister, came in a little earlier than me, shows up to be my temporary sponsor. I had no idea. And I was like, oh my God, she walks in. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, those coincidences that happen, God doing things in my life and me not planning it. And it started just building these, all these things that start building our hope and building our faith. So we take off, we go to this meeting down at Dry Dock. And I walk in and I'm like, oh my God, you know, like the floors are like this, and there's the smoke back in the day in 1989, you know, everything. And I'm a smoker and I'm judging all these smokers, you know. It's like smoke billowing in the room. Everybody's old, they're crusty. It's Friday night. This is where my life has ended up. Great, you know. And so my mind was trying to obsess. My mind was trying to get me out again. And it will never just come up and say, hey, Marion, I want to get you high. Hey, Marion, I want to get you drunk. It's going to figure out all these other excuses. Well, you got to get home to the kids. Oh, you're better than these stupid people at Dry Dock. See, that's the deal. You know, we're egomaniacs with low self-esteem. You know, Peter, he talks about Park Avenue to Park Bench. You know, man, I was either the lowest piece of crud under there, or I'm way too good for these people at this Dry Dock meeting, you know. And I'm sitting there, and I don't know, I'm just like a strong believer. God, I don't even know if I ever saw this woman again in my life, but there was this Native American woman who was sitting against the wall, and all of a sudden she opens her mouth and she starts speaking. And she was talking about being a mom, and she was talking about where her addiction and alcoholism brought her. And something pierced my heart. See, I just believe that God, you know, I heard this thing yesterday in this movie, and I love it. It's actually a scripture that talks about God, you know, changing, giving us from a heart of stone to a heart of flesh. And I feel like my heart of stone, those closed off places, became a heart of flesh, and I was able to receive what that woman said that day. And that's the only other time that this disease really tried to pull me away. And I've been on this road ever since. I joined the rooms of CA. I was telling some friends about this. We had this Shakey's Pizza, had this meeting on Friday night, and it was a candlelight meeting, and it was in this back room, and it was 10 o'clock on Friday night. Man, that was freaking awesome. I had to have a spiritual experience strong enough to overcome my alcoholism and addiction. And I would sit in that room and I just felt like it was magic. I was like, wow, these people are spiritual. Whoa, this is so cool. And they're just like me. And that's the things that started growing my faith and started building my faith. You know, a lot of people had relapsed through that. I stayed sober. The rooms of CA in Bellingham, Washington, during that time, 1989, they diminished and they got really small. And I got really afraid. You know, there wasn't a lot of people in the steps and in the solution. There wasn't a lot of that going on. And I needed to find a place where I could call home. And I I became a member of the Northwest Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was my home group for 20 years before moving to South Florida. We were a clubhouse. We were people that worked a lot with newcomers, and that's what I did. I found my first commitment as an ashtray washer in that room, you know, and I found a sense of belonging, and I found a sense of hope there. And that's just what worked for me, because I needed to get into the book and I needed to get into the solution. You know, I started being of service to the old treatment center I went to. As soon as I got a year, I was like signed up on that commitment once a week to go in there to a treatment center and share my experience, strength, and hope. And so that's the foundation of how I found the rooms of CANA wherever. And, you know, like I said, across the board, it's all about God for me, having a life of service, having a servant's heart. That's what my sponsor's always telling me. You know, I can call her and I can complain about my life, and she's just like, in her simple southern drawl, she'll just say, "Oh, Mary, just go help somebody. Just go help somebody," you know. And I love that about her, you know. It's like, pray for a servant's heart, pray for a servant's heart. So that's what I try to do today, to stay out of my own way, you know. I get to do this stuff with him. This is definitely, wasn't like I want to sign up to be a circuit speaker or any of that kind of stuff. Whether I'm working with a drunk one-on-one or whether I'm getting to do this. You know, they told me in the early days, you know, that, you know, write down those dreams and write down those goals of the things that you want in your life. And my life is far surpassed anything I could have ever imagined. I've got to really, you know, I've been the starving musician with a buck in my pocket, and I've had a couple dollars in my pocket. I've lived in a big, beautiful home with 20 acres, and I've lived in, rented a room for $200 a month. And those are things, it's about what's happened on the inside. And Peter talks about this too, you know, whether you can be at peace and happy for a banquet or for a bag of peanuts, you know, and God's given me that life today to be grateful in either way. So that's just the beginning for what I have to say mm-hmm. this morning.
Thank you.
Peter, recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Peter.
Marilyn talked about living in a town with the most hippies. I'm from Brooklyn. We have the town for the most gangsters. And the book says we're people who normally would not mix. It makes absolutely no sense. I mean, she's like butterflies and rainbows, and I'm like, you're talking to me? It's the whole thing doesn't, the whole thing doesn't make sense. A couple of considerations. My sponsor would always tell me, we got to take a look at where are we currently? Where are we right now? Not what we did last week or last year or even more than that. Where are we currently? Where are we currently in the steps? We're currently in a circle and a triangle. Am I top heavy in fellowship and have little or nothing going on with steps and service and sponsorship specifically? And do we want to get past where we currently are? When I drink alcohol, I like to drink more alcohol because I like to get drunker. And if we're experiencing some freedom, do we want to get freer? And if we're in a place of bondage, do we want to get past that? All the self-imposed crisis, all created by this wonderful predator called the thinking mind. Do we want to get past where we currently are? If I'm a chronic relapser, why? Is it that I'm just not done and still running around reservations, a lurking notion that somehow, someday I can control and manage and enjoy my life and my drinking? Or am I truly out of road? And if I'm truly out of road, then I needed a pointed teacher. And the best teacher you can get is the one God sends you, is to get you past you. Because we need to experience the depth of self for successful living. But I need to know what the problem is. I know nothing about cars and how to turn my car on. That's about it. If it needs oil, I go to a mechanic. I probably change a flat, but I'm useless when it comes to cars. I'm not like that guy who knows how to fix cars. I'm a wimp when it comes to that. So if I happen to be driving down the road and I hear a thumping sound in my car, I'll do what most guys do. I open up the hood and look around waiting for something to happen. but I don't know what to do. I don't know what the problem is, which means there's no way I can start to repair it and work on a solution. And you'll be surprised, especially if you knew how many folks are running around in the fellowship who have no idea what's wrong with them. So how could you even work on a solution? And what you do, you grasp at straws. Because I've gone to lots of meetings over the years, and when I first got down to Florida, I was sitting in a beginner's meeting. A buddy of mine says, let's go to this place, and we're sitting in this beginner's meeting. And after the speaker gave their story, they were sharing to the floor. And I would say about 10 people shared 10 different ways to get sober. And I'm sitting there going, now if I was new, how do I decide who to listen to? But there is one way that works, and that's in the first portion of the big book. A direct route to get me, past me, and right with God. And through a spiritual conversion, a spiritual awakening, a spiritual transformation, revolution, what happens is we get recovered from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. We're given a new mind, if you will, a mind that is through godliness, a mind that is not telling me to go drink. So if it's not telling me to drink, or it's not telling me to drug, my body's not drinking and drugging. And then we even get past that, where the things that would haunt me when I'm not using the sex sprees, the food sprees, the money sprees, the thinking sprees, the fear sprees, whatever spree it might be, that gets removed little by slowly as the ego gets grinded into dust as a direct result of God. And our book says no one has sunk too low. So whether it's Park Avenue or Park Bench, God is God, not a respecter of men. We're just his children, and he doesn't have stepchildren. So we take a look at where we currently, we have a fellowship that we come to, and inside the fellowship is this program which is laid out in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. That's two pieces, because you can't get a three-legged stool to stay on two legs or one leg. And then once we get into the fellowship, the sacred fellowship, you find a program, and a sponsor will point you to the instructions in the big book, and we follow the instructions truly out of desperation. And if it isn't desperation, I'll probably putter out right away. And then once we start to wake up, somewhere in there we have this shift, this point of view change, and in the third part of this, we start to sponsor people and give it away. And it's not only about practice sponsoring people, but we find ourselves moved to practice principles in all our affairs. And the very same person who was sitting in front of me with 10 days and going through the work, in 6 months they're completely new people. Some of them don't even look the same. Are we in a place of resistance or acceptance? Compliance or surrender? Dis-ease and discomfort, or peace, ease, and comfort? Do I walk with desperate, that feeling of desperation all the time? Not the type of desperation that makes us come to a fellowship to get better. Not the kind of desperation that moves me to get the treatment. I'm talking about while we're sober, we still have this quiet desperation. That, oh my God, I know the shoe's going to fall off any minute. Something bad's going to happen to me. Am I looking to get better or feel better? Because if I'm looking to feel better, a new relationship is going to feel good for a little while. You get the honeymoon phase. I love you, no, I love you more, and I love you even more. You know, I love you more. And you're in the living room, and she goes in the kitchen, and she comes back, don't ever leave me again, that was too strong. And become quickly codependent caretakers, and they become your mate becomes your God. And we both go to detox together. So am I looking to feel better or get better? Feel better. I get some money, get a new job, get a new car, I feel better. Getting better is a little different. Because getting better, I may not feel better right away. Because everything is going to be challenged. Everything. And a good sponsor and a fellowship, a good home group is going to challenge, lovingly confront us. Like perhaps the way we dress to go speak at a meeting, or perhaps who we're hanging out with, the people, places, and things. Perhaps we're not praying, and someone is going to jump all over that. And we can recoil from that, saying, hey, it's my business and not yours, and failing to see they're trying to save our life. And the spiritual walk will challenge every facet of our life. When we begin to pray, we see our prayer brings death to every identity that does not come from God. It's the removal and the process of recovery, a subtraction, never addition. This book, what this book does is not add on. We don't need extras. What this book does is a really good job of taking a very sharp knife and cutting away the stuff that we don't need, that we thought we did need. We accumulate stuff on the way into this fellowship. We accumulate stuff in a time where maybe 5, 6, or 7 when the ego starts to respond. And then the ego starts to breathe and starts to feed off contempt and fear and prejudice and skepticism and doubt and entitlement. It goes on ad infinitum. So by the time we land into a treatment center or a 12-step fellowship, we don't only have a drinking or drug problem, which is a symptom of a greater problem. We got a whole World War II going on in here. And going to meetings is not really going to pull that out. We have a lot of plaque on the soul. And only God's sword is going to be able to shed us, take that away from us. Which means I'm not going to be feeling too good. I'm going to be walking around going, I think I'm really sick. That's a great thing. Because it's in the realization of our brokenness that we begin to get free, and the denial of my brokenness that we stay in bondage. I watch a lot of folks get this book early, which is wonderful. But because they got the book early, which is wonderful, and they now feel and believe they can't show cracks in the armor anymore. I'm in the big book, there's nothing wrong with me. I can't even share. I'm afraid today. Guys, I will tell you, I'm sober 29 years. I've been afraid many times. I've had moments of doubt and skepticism. I've had moments where that thing, we all have that thing, that hurts. People who've betrayed us, it hurts the heart. Losing loved ones, it hurts. And sometimes we just feel like God is not listening to me. I'm praying, I'm meditating, I'm serving others, and God doesn't even know I exist. Mother Teresa talked about this. She had this. I'm going to get it. And I have gotten it. And all I do is chop wood and carry water. And as my sponsor said, no matter how bad we're feeling, no matter how uncomfortable circumstances are, his plea to God is, no matter what you do, I'm not leaving you. And somehow we come out on the other side a little bit more pristine, a little bit more cleaner. So we'll take a look when we come back at really what step one is telling us. The lack of power, choice, control in the mind before we drink, in the body after we pick up. And what does unmanageability really mean? What are we talking about here? The two parts of the first step. A lot of us go right past the dash. What does step one tell us? Because I can't do 2 through 9 and go into 10, 11, 12 without step one. I'll keep getting drunk. So we're going to take a 5-minute, 15-minute break. We'll come back 11:15. Thanks.